My guest today, Jean Bricmont, is based in Brussels, where he is a mathematical and statistical physicist at the University of Louvain. Outside of Belgium, he is better known for his commentaries on Western hypocrisy and particularly the excuse of humanitarian intervention to pursue imperialist policies and regime change. He is the author of Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War, about which I interviewed him several years ago. I reached him a few moments ago in the French countryside. So welcome Jean Bricmont, who takes on the world.
Thank you, Jeff.
I'm really glad to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Particularly after yesterday's events. You said yesterday that the Western governments use these violent Islamist forces, the ones who carried out the attack yesterday, for their purposes to destabilize the Syrian and Libyan governments, largely because they did not like those governments who had not attacked us in any way. You compare it with what happened in Afghanistan when the West used the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union leading up to 9/11. The late Chalmers Johnson described that this as blowback. Is there a term for that in French?
Retour de manivelle. It's a complicated word, but yeah, there is blowback. Yeah, it's blowback. But of course, you see, the problem is that I don't think that the West has a really coherent policy. They sometimes fight the Islamists, sometimes they support them, they kill some of them. So, you see, I think we should go back to a more realistic policy. I think there is a lot of talk now about love and peace and everybody should love each other in Belgium and we shouldn't be racist and so on. But the fact is that in the Middle East, I'm not talking about the population in our country, that's different, the population of North African origin. But in the Middle East and North Africa, I think nobody really likes us, okay? But there's still a difference between two sorts of people. There are those who don't like us, want to us to leave them in peace, not intervene in their internal affairs, and then deal with their own problems. I think the Algerian government, well, the defunct Libyan government, the Syrian government, etc., are of that sort. And then there are people who hate us but are willing to come and kill civilians at random. I think we should make a difference between those two sorts of people. I don't think, you know, the Syrian government likes us, given all what we have done to them, or the Palestinians, for that matter, or the Lebanese, or the Hezbollah, or the Iranians. But nevertheless, they are not sending people to kill us, you know, at random in the street, where the Islamic State does, or whoever is behind that. I don't know, but let's say the Islamic State, they say they do it. So I think that's a big difference, and I think we should at least recognize that fact. And we should not make enemies of people who don't do anything to us.
Well, it's interesting that Hillary Clinton, speaking Monday before the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, took the neocon and Israeli government line of making Iran and Hezbollah and Syria the big enemies, and she's equated ISIS with Hezbollah, ISIS with Hamas, and so on, and even
in
And so maybe you could comment about the this effort to lump all those who are even actually the ones who are fighting ISIS in Syria as the same as ISIS.
Yeah, I know. They do that all the time. And Trump has gone out of his way. I mean, has gone to the extreme to attack Iran and sponsor of terrorism and so on, for which there is no evidence, at least in recent years. I don't see where they support terrorism against us. There has been some terrorist attack in the past, but not recently. So, you see, I wanted to say, because I think we like that, we are attacked from two sides. We are attacked from above by the Zionists and the neocons and so on who are controlling the political process in the United States, to a large extent also the political process in Europe, and in any case, Europe is subservient to the United States, so in that sense, the control of the United States extends to us. And then that's from above. They control it. The AIPAC was a joke. I mean, the two leading candidates, which unfortunately I think will be in November, everything they say was just a joke. It's a fairy tale. Okay, it's total subservient to the United States. And then they're attacked from the bottom by these Islamist terrorists. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not saying they're manipulated, but the fact is that, of course, because of these attacks, the anger of people is against those who attack us. Obviously, the manipulation, the AIPAC and so on, that's not visible. The press never mentions it, so, of course, most people don't think about it. And then there are even nationalists. You know, there are a lot of nationalist forces in Europe, but these nationalist forces, not all of them, but several of them, are very pro-Israel because they're anti-Muslim. And they're anti-Muslim because of these attacks and other things like that. And the Israelis now, of course, make one declaration after another saying, ah, Europe must become like Israel, they must fight terrorism, they must stop boycotting Israeli products, etc., etc. So the situation is quite, you know, awful from my point of view, because indeed, you know, I think one of our problems with the Middle East, not the only one, but certainly a long one, a very, 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 going back many, many years, I think I remember seeing Bin Laden saying, we attack you because you attack us for 80 years in Palestine. And one of the roots of our problem with the Middle East, which is not linked to oil, is, of course, our support for Israel. But we have no choice. I mean, our politicians, you know that there'll be, you know, there'll be campaigns against them. There are lawsuits. I mean, there's lawsuit after lawsuit for anti-Semitism here. You know, free speech when it comes to anti-Semitism simply does not exist. Even people who make remarks, then you know that very well. Also in the United States, where free speech exists in principle, people who make anti-Israeli remarks or too radical ones, etc., are, you know, if not taken to court, slandered, etc. You've seen even in the pro-Palestinian movement, they do that. They do that with Alison Zaire or people like you. You know that very well. So there's total control on that issue. We can't get rid of it. We should at least say, okay, Israel, take care of yourself. You're in the Middle East, you take care of yourself. We don't have anything to do with you anymore. At least that would be one step in the right direction. It wouldn't solve all our problems, but it would be one step in the right direction. We can't do that. And then, of course, we have these crazy people who attack us. And that, of course, increases our alignment to, you know, a sort of attitude to, you know, to align ourselves with Israel and the United States. I mean, increase security measures, increase police state, etc. So we are taken into, you know, we are attacked from both sides in a way.
Looking at the role of the United States and our politicians, our candidates, like to talk about this as the greatest nation in the world, or we're the indispensable. I agree, but not the way they portray it. But if you look around at the world today, the situation in Africa, the intervention first, well, we could go back to Afghanistan, as you mentioned in your statement, Afghanistan supporting the Mujahideen. But then the invasion of Iraq, the regime change, overthrowing the three secular or two of the three secular regimes, powerful regimes in the Middle East. But the one in Libya opened the coffers of the armaments that then were taken to Mali, Boko Haram. Everyone, we hear most about Europe, but we don't hear very much about the connections with the overthrow of Gaddafi, which our Democratic presidential presumptive candidate Hillary Clinton was the cheering section for here.
Yeah, sure.
As a matter of fact,
the problem with these things, they say, oh, it's wonderful we have put the democracy in Libya, which they haven't, because they don't care, for example, about the side effect, if you can call it, the collateral damage to other countries that have done nothing. Like, as you say, Boko Haram or Algeria. Algeria is facing a terrorist threat now. They aren't happy. They were not happy with the intervention, at least not the government. I mean, you know, Lebanon is destabilized by the war in Syria. I mean, the fact is that, you know, but I want to say something, you know. Now there is a popular slogan in the left in Europe which say, their wars are deaths, meaning we the people, are suffering the killings and the governments do the wars. But I can assure you that outside of Britain, there's not been any consistent anti-war movement or anti-interventionist movement. And when there was the Libyan war, maybe we were 40 demonstrating in front of the U.S. embassy. And the parliament in Belgium voted unanimously in favor of the war. That went from the Greens to the far right. So there is no problem. When it comes to human rights, they all agree. I could give you leaflets, if you want, that were done by the far left, including everybody, the communists, the Trotskyists, the anarchists, the so-called anti-colonialists, everybody, the human rights people, the Greens, everybody, calling for intervention in Libya before it occurred. So I think the left is not willing to envision the fact that it has been supporting all these interventions. I've been to debate, I've been debate about Syria. I said, look, this is an internal affair, we shouldn't intervene there. Everybody wanted to support the rebellion. And of course, they did support the rebellion, well, in various ways. It's not completely clear how they did, but they did it in many ways. They refused to cooperate with the Damascus government, who wanted to help them with security measures. Now, the Damascus government said, well, look at what happens with terrorism. And, you know, it seems to me that the left has a lot to ask itself about because of this idea that we have to spread democracy by bombs and overthrow government and maneuver, etc., which in the end, of course, gives a blank check to the CIA and the US Air Force because the left in Europe is totally helpless. They have no control over the government. They have no military force anyway. They couldn't do anything on their own. So what they are doing is being cheerleader for American intervention because only the US has the force to intervene. And that's what they do. Whether they do it consciously or by stupidity and rhetoric and so on, that's another question. But that's what they do. And I'm very angry at that because, you know, in England, for example, there is a movement called Stop the War Coalition, and that movement is against all war, period, all non-defensive war. That's a good step. That should exist. Nothing like that exists in France or Belgium.
Or in the United States, after large...
Or in the United States. And, of course, I mean, to go back to your favorite subject, it is, I think, related to, you know, a sort of left Zionism. I mean, there are a lot of people who are, I could call, you know, Zionist with a human face, I would say. And in my experience, at least, many of these people are invariably in favor of humanitarian or so-called humanitarian interventions, which by accident are also done against enemies of Israel, or at least people who are thought to be enemies of Israel, like Saddam Hussein, Assad, and, you know, Gaddafi. Nothing is done for Yemen, for example. Nothing is done for Bahrain, for example. Why? Because that's Saudi Arabia. Why don't they do something about Saudi Arabia violating international law in Bahrain and in Yemen, blatantly, with horrible human rights consequences?
It's interesting that we have this. Saudi Arabia has beheaded, is the champion beheader, is the role model for beheading in the Middle East, but we never hear about criticism, or it's very lukewarm if there's any criticism about human rights in Saudi Arabia. The president, Obama, goes to Cuba and maybe he feels he has to do that, but yes, he lectures Cuba about human rights and people and political prisoners. This is a country which has more prisoners than any other country in the world, and many of them, so many of them, serving prison sentences for which they were unjustly sentenced. Almost every week or two, we read in the newspaper someone has been in prison for 30 years for a crime he didn't commit, it's usually a man, is released having lost the better part of their life. And no country in the world competes with this. We're the number one when it keeps people in prison.
Yeah.
The issue about the anti-war movement, it's difficult it was one thing. It's when a president who's a Democrat gets elected, like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, the movement rolls over. But even when George W. Bush was president and pushing the war in Iraq, it disappeared. It vanished. A large movement vanished and never reappeared. And I remember my late friend Alexander Coburn writing about that. But people didn't want to hear that there was no left. It's a strange phenomenon, but as you say, in Europe, it doesn't seem to be any better, or maybe even worse in some respects.
No, it's especially because we are not the empire; we are just subservient. I was amazed. I want to say that to my friends, that will make them upset. But the most progressive foreign policy initiative has been the one done by Donald Trump when he said he should get out of NATO. Why don't we say that we should get out of NATO? We never say that. You see, in principle, it may be somewhere in some political program of the Communist Party or something. But they never advertise that. It's never made an issue. I think the issue of getting out of NATO, making peace with Russia and so on, is absolutely important. And it's never discussed. And again, in the left, you see the hatred for Russia and Putin is just amazing. It's just like in the mainstream press. It's even more. It's amazing. I mean, recently there was a prominent green politician who was asked something by radio, which is RT, Russia Today, okay, somebody working for Russia Today, but in French. And they asked him something about bees disappearing. He's a green guy. And then they say, what radio are you? Russia Today, Russia. Oh, I don't talk to you. I don't like Putin. That's it. I mean, it's completely irrational, but, and this guy is quite famous, I mean, in France at least. And you see, it seems to me that they are they're just as gung-ho. When there was the Maidan thing, there was no consideration given to the fact that the U.S. had poured billions of dollars into the business of Ukraine, and, it's a big democracy and so on. Now it's a big mess, but, you know, nobody cares. I mean, when there was the Kosovo business, you had to bomb Serbia to liberate the Kosovo. Now, of course, if the Russians were to bomb Ukraine to liberate the eastern part of Ukraine, which want to get rid of the central government, that would be a nuclear war. So, I mean, the double standards are glaring and constant, but the left really has not a critical attitude with respect to that. They have also allowed, you know, this idea that, oh, it would be so nice if there was democracy everywhere and open borders, etc. But, of course, that's not what is happening. What is happening is, U.S. domination where it works and chaos where it doesn't work.
You know, my guest is Jean Brigmont. We're speaking to him from France about the implications of the attacks on Belgium and how far and who is responsible. And a lot of arrows point across the Atlantic to Washington. It's interesting, the American people have absolutely no consciousness or even entertain the thought that somehow the United States might be responsible for all these problems from Africa to Belgium. Essentially, if the United States was not so heavily involved in this, we would not have this situation. But nobody here will discuss that. It's just do more of the same. And I find it interesting. You brought up NATO, my thought was in terms of Ukraine, which is involved in this as well, is that without Ukraine or before the Ukraine coup and Russia taking back Crimea, which most people aren't really aware of here, that actually was handed over to Ukraine on a paper signature by Khrushchev, which didn't mean anything on the ground at the time. You have a situation which they were asking questions if NATO was still worth saving, that there were serious discussions, do we need NATO? And suddenly the Ukraine situation came along, and NATO is now more important than ever.
Yeah.
And the Americans had been complaining that the European countries were not spending enough on arms, meaning supporting the U.S. economy. And maybe you could comment on that, because there's no discussion of NATO in this country, none, zero.
Well, apparently Trump said that he wants to get out of NATO because it's too costly. You see, the point is that I think one has to make a distinction between the militarist and the capitalist. The real capitalist, and I think Trump is a good example of that, don't want to spend more money on the military unless they sell weapons. But not the U.S. economy is not only based on selling weapons. But there is the militarist and the human rights and the interventionist and Zionist and the neocons. I mean, all this ideological wing is creating the war party and wants, of course, more provocation to Russia and more NATO, etc. But I think it's important that the left understand who is whom in that thing. Maybe people like Trump are horrible on some issues, but then on other issues, he may be better because he has the capitalists have realized they've lost a lot. On the whole, the wars have cost a lot of money to the U.S. economy. And the beneficiaries are just few. I mean, they're not, of course, there is the military-industrial complex. That's true. But, lots of big business are not directly in the military-industrial complex. And, certainly people like Trump think they lose money in that. And even, by the way, Trump said that he benefited from construction work that was requested by the U.S. Army in the bases. But himself, he says, we spend too much money on that. If you really think of the good of the country, even of the good of the capitalist class as a whole, then I think you should realize that this is actually a waste of money, this military buildup, which, of course, it is. I mean, what do you do with that?
Well, obviously, before the situation in Ukraine, the European governments were not interested in spending money on weapons, and the public wasn't either. They actually are preferred being spent on things like health care and public education, in which the United States trails.
Sure. But you see, there is a contradiction. There is a contradiction, and also you can see that in Europe, that there is the interventionists or the people, who, for example, in countries that are not part of NATO, part of the political spectrum, maybe a large part of the elite want to join NATO or they want to join the European Union if they are not in it. But the population don't want that. That's true. But then, of course, the people who want that may want it for ideological reasons, not simply for economic reasons. I could be very well. I've met people whom you would call capitalists who are not for that build-up, military build-up. And I think the left should realize who is whom in that, because I have a lot of discussion where people think it's all a plot by the capitalists, by the ideological aspect. And if we could convince people that war is not in our interest, it's not even in the interest of large fraction of the capitalist class, then we could have a much larger front in favor of peace, which I think is a crucial issue, independently of what we think of capitalism. I'm all critical of capitalism, but it's a separate issue, at least partly separate issue. And, you know, I mean, it's just like Israel. I mean, Israel, as you know very well, has never brought us a drop of oil. They've never helped us geostrategically. They just do what they want, and then they ask us to support them, and then they send the lobby if we don't. I mean, this is a completely, you know, ideological, and for them, even for the people in the lobby, it's just ideological. It's just, you know, identity politics. It's nothing, they aren't really benefiting from that except a few individuals. The Jews are not benefiting as a whole from this crazy policy.
Well, it puts them, those who are at the core of the lobby, gives them a position of power and influence in Washington.
That's true.
Which is something money can buy. and that kind of access is very important to certain people, that they can walk
That's
into
true.
A member of congressman's office and be honored as if they were a very important person, because with their checkbooks they are very important. And the fact every year AIPAC adds 2,000 more to the attendance, and it's so big this year that they had to move from the Washington Convention Center, where it's historically been held, because they didn't have enough room there for the crowd, and they had like 18,700, and 4,000 of them are paid, are college students whose trip and ticket and accommodations are paid for by the lobby to reinforce or save what is Israel's declining reputation in the United States. One of the things, it may not be clear over in Europe, but the base of the Democratic Party no longer is strongly supportive of Israel. As a matter of fact, Israel's not on their agenda, and this is why it has not been a subject for any of the Democratic debates, because the candidates kind of control what the questions are going to be in this case. And Hillary Clinton saved all her words of love for Israel for articles in the American Jewish press and organizations like the Council of Foreign Relations or the Chaim Saban Forum. So it's very interesting, this election, where the Democrats rely on pro-Israel money, but the base doesn't care about Israel.
Yeah, that's true. That I understand. No, I understand all that.
Yeah.
But you see, on the Republican side, it's interesting too, because Trump, even though he has also made all this love of Israel at AIPAC, yes, he thinks that the neocons don't like, the elite of the Republican Party is against him, and the base does follow him, even though he does not follow the neocon line. He's against, in words at least. Of course, I don't trust him. I don't know what he's going to do. I think he's a demagogue. That's another question. But nevertheless, if you listen to what he says, he's changing the party line. I think you were probably in Washington with Justin Raimundo on this meeting about this Israel good for the United States, and I think Raimundo made a clear point that he did break with the orthodoxy of neocon within the Republican Party, which is something one should credit him for, whatever else he does elsewhere.
Well, there's not much to credit him for, but he at AIPAC, he made the first actually written, prepared speech, But he was counting on the fact that most of his supporters will not be watching his presentation at AIPAC.
Of course.
And like most of Clinton's supporters will not be watching it either. So he did the politically correct thing as a salesperson. He told them what they wanted to hear.
But the point which is interesting is that outside of that, when he speaks to the Republican base, he does not follow an interventionist policy, and nevertheless he gets their vote. So of course he may be lying. I don't know when he's telling the truth and when that I don't know. But nevertheless, it's interesting that he has shown that you can get the vote without towing the neocon line. That's the point. That, of course, shows that the base, of course, I think the base of the Republican Party was never for the neocon line. But the neocons convinced the Republicans that they couldn't win without following the neocon line, you see? And then they followed that line for a long time. But the base, I don't know, there are lots of idiots there, and there are, religious fanatics and God knows what. But you see, even the religious fanatics, they are voting for Trump, apparently, even though for a while, it was believed that the Christian Zionists were controlling them and you had to be a fanatical Zionist in order to get the vote of the Christian fundamentalists. But it's not true. You know, Trump gets as many votes as Cruz. Cruz, of course, is following the line. Cruz is following the line. He's a Christian fundamentalist and he's surrounded by neocons and all this entourage is neocon. That's true. But he's not successful. I mean, he's not more successful than Trump. Well, of course, we have to wait till the convention and see what trick will be played there, etc. That's another story. That would be interesting to watch. But nevertheless, I think Trump has, whether he's honest or not, I don't care, but he has shown a point, he has proven a point.
Well, actually, the neocons are at this point appear to be backing Hillary, and they're, as you say, they're frightened of Trump because Trump was able to say, even though he changed his tune in front of AIPAC, but to the national audience, a much bigger audience than AIPAC, that he would be neutral. And by getting away with this, this threatens to bring down the whole image of the Israel lobby and the support of Israel as being a dominant factor in U.S. elections. In fact, Marco Rubio was the most abject supporter of Israel. He's received major money from Paul Singer, the hedge fund operator who is economically strangling Argentina. Sheldon Adelson was about to give him support. And he accused on public television of Obama betraying Netanyahu, and look what happened to him. He was washed out. I mean, he literally was a failure as a political candidate, taking a pro-Israel line. So obviously, this didn't help Israel's credentials in terms of being a key issue in American politics.
Yeah, that's true. Times are changing. We should be happy. You should be happy about it. Maybe it's thanks to you in part, but times are changing. And also in Europe, you see. But of course, the problem, as I say, they're all, now the Islamists, of course, with this absolutely crazy terror attack, give an argument, not only to the Zionists, but to our so-called nationalist far right, where actually then, if they were real nationalists, I mean, for example, they are really nasty, if you wish, but in Hungary, there are these Jobbik who are really nationalists. I don't know what they are. They are not pro-Israel, you see. Maybe they are fascist, I don't know. Maybe they are anti-Semitic, I don't know. But you see, most of the far right is fanatically pro-Israel. And of course, they get more argument to be pro-Israel. I have discussion with people. You see, there are people who are not aware or don't care about the stranglehold of the pro-Israel lobby on a foreign policy, because they hate so much the Muslim, and of course they can say, well, who is shooting in the street? It's not the Israelis, it's not the Zionists, of course not. It's the Muslim. That's the problem. Now, each time they do these crazy things, they make the situation of people who would like to have a reasonable foreign policy more difficult.
Getting back to the recent events, I'm aware that after the November attacks in Paris, there is a totally different atmosphere on the streets of Paris in terms of a military presence. Is that still the same? Probably today it's even more so than ever. But how much does that change life there?
Oh, I don't think maybe I'm not, maybe just because I'm white and so on, I'm not bothered by them. But you do see, of course, policemen with, what do you call that, rifle gun or whatever it's called, automatic weapons in the street. Yes, you see that in Belgium too. But obviously it didn't prevent the attack yesterday. How could they? How could they? I mean, there are these few people in the street, but if I'm a terrorist, I'm just going to go somewhere else. I mean, it just... and if people are willing to die, you see, that's the whole problem. Once people are willing to die to do what they do, that's not so easy to arrest them. And the only way, in my opinion, the only way to fight them is by police method. And that's actually, there are books written about that. You see, you have to infiltrate those groups, and then, of course, you have to arrest them. That's the only way to fight terrorism at home, at least. Then, of course, there is the idea of fighting them in Syria or in Iraq, but that's a different story. That's really for the people there to do it. But I don't think we can solve any problem by going there and bombing, especially since we don't bomb with the Syrian government. We just bomb like that, but not very efficiently. So, there's nothing, that doesn't do any good except making us more hated.
What do you see as the developments in Europe, in Western Europe, coming after this attack in response to it, because is further crackdown Muslim, further intensive police action in Muslim communities, targeting, harassing the majority of Muslims who are innocent and not connected to this group?
Yeah, but you see, one should not be too idealistic about the situation in the Muslim community. I have friends who live there and who are even from origin. I have a friend, for example, he says that, he gets death threats all the time from young Muslims because he's supposed to be a Alawite or a Shiite, although he's not religious. But you see, the tension is really quite terrible with a minority of the youth. But it's a minority which is active, and you can really see. So, of course, I don't know if the police is going to solve that. I don't think they are. But, as I say, the real problem is really to infiltrate the real terrorist group. But if you talk about the sentiment of the, the Arab youth, there is an enormous amount of resentment towards us, which, of course, can be understood because of discrimination and so on, but you should not forget that not every group has reacted in this violent way to being discriminated. People have been discriminated. Many migrant communities have been discriminated and badly treated and so on. And the level of violence that we see here is really something we have to think about. I don't know what to do about it, but one should not just say, the left tends to have an idealistic view, the same way they had an idealistic view of the Syrian resistance or Syrian insurrection. They say, they are against a dictatorial regime, so we should support them, etc. Well, one has to think about there are differences between insurrections. So there are some insurrections that kill civilians at random, and those that don't. There are those who always attack military people foremost. Not the same thing. I think Cuba, for example, I don't think the Cuban guerrilleros, when they were guerrilleros, were killing civilians at random.
Well, this is the same insurrection. This is a subject that is going to be with us for quite a while. So let me thank you, Jean, for being our guest today on Takes on the World, taking time out to speak with us about this situation.
Thank you for inviting me, Jeff. Thank you very much.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.